Well, thank you all for inviting me, and good luck to you next hour. I want to do a couple of things. I've been asked to speak about the challenges facing the pension system, and I've had the privilege of participating in the Ontario Expert Commission on Pensions and heard a lot of submissions from employee groups and employer groups, and I want to reflect a little bit on that. But I think here today, tonight, more than that, what I'd like to do is speak to three challenges that I think, I would argue, arise in this kind of interesting intersection between trade union politics and pension plans. One of the interesting things that happens when these two worlds intersect is that possibilities arise. They're two complex worlds, and they're two quite different worlds, as you all know. You participate in both, and I witness both. They're quite different, and yet there is an important sense in which the two overlap, and I think there are three challenges that I'd like to talk a little bit about that afford opportunities for those from the trade union movement to work through their pension plans in a way that's perfectly lawful and consistent with the mandates of those funds to advance a social agenda that is very much embraced by the trade union movement. So three challenges that arise on this interface between trade unionism and pension plans, and three ways in which pension plans and your unique position with pension plans as trustees of those institutions may be amenable to change. So, challenge number one. Paul mentioned it's not a new challenge. It obviously came up last year and probably the year before and has come up a lot this year. We've heard a lot about it at the Ontario Commission. The first challenge is coverage. Pension coverage in the private sector is in deep crisis. There's little doubt about that. It's in crisis in a quantitative sense, and it's in crisis in a qualitative sense. In a quantitative sense, the levels of pension coverage steadily, although not yet dramatically, are declining. Steady decline, not yet dramatic, but a lot of pieces are in place that would suggest that the decline will be more precipitous. And qualitative, because even where pension coverage continues, it doesn't continue in the same form. We see more pension plans in the private sector that are being converted, sometimes to defined contribution plans, sometimes to no plan at all, sometimes to an RRSP arrangement. We see a general degradation of quality in the private sector alongside this steady decline in quantity. Now, why is this happening? No one has an undisputed explanation for this phenomenon. But what we do know is that it is international in scope. It's not just happening in Ontario. It's not just happening in Canada. It's not just happening in North America. It's happening in every developed economy in which the private workplace has been the basis for pension coverage. It's an international phenomenon. It's not a new phenomenon. In fact, Canada's behind the curve, just as we have not yet suffered the decline in unionization density that we've seen in the U.S. We may be on that road, but we haven't suffered it quite as severely yet. We haven't suffered quite the degree of pension coverage decline, but that's a factor as well, the decline in union density. What are employers saying today? No surprise. They're saying it's expensive to provide a DB plan. They're saying they have to be internationally competitive, and it's difficult to be internationally competitive with a defined benefit plan. They're saying that these plans are volatile. They experience gains, they experience losses, and when they experience losses, their funding costs go up. They're saying that they're governed by new international accounting rules that require them to measure those liabilities on a mark-to-market basis, in other words, with very little flexibility. And they're concerned because the pension plans that they put in place at the end of the Second World War have now grown and matured. And because they've matured, they have a mountain of retirees and a much smaller base of active members than they did 20 and 30 years ago. And that creates very interesting funding challenges for pension plans, because if assets go down and they're a big part of your pension scheme, the only way to make them up, of course, is through increased contributions. If you have a very small workforce because you've downsized and you've moved people out to Mexico or you've moved them out to Asia, you don't have a large workforce actively contributing to the plan, then that burden becomes even tougher to bear. So the dynamics of the economy that have resulted in the shrinkage of the manufacturing sector, the movement of manufacturing jobs offshore, the development of the service sector, in which we've seen no real defined benefit pension emerge, the increased international competition from low-wage areas that continues to put pressure on our private sector, all these factors, combined with decreased union density, underlie the deterioration in the private sector of defined benefit coverage. Now, what does this mean more broadly, and what does it mean to people in this room? Well, more broadly, it means that there is a social crisis of some sort that is taking place. Retirement income is not just a private affair. It is what separates people from poverty once they can no longer work. And it separates great numbers of people from poverty when they can no longer work. So to the extent that this system declines, to the extent that it deteriorates, it's not just a local problem. It becomes a social problem, a societal problem. And it's one that you can see today. You can see its outline. You can see it emerging. We know that politically, we've seen this in Ontario under the Harris government, when the private sector is under this kind of pressure, private sector workers are under this kind of pressure, especially in recessionary circumstances, and they're seeing cutbacks and they're seeing layoffs, it is very easy to point to the public sector and to try to build a resentment against the public sector, and that has been a successful strategy for some of our more conservative political parties. So as defined benefit pension coverage in the private sector is under pressure, as it contracts, as it deteriorates in quality, one of the possibilities for the next period of time is that there'd be a certain amount of resentment that's organized and directed towards the public sector in much the same way we saw it in the Harris years in Ontario. So that's a problem for the public sector. It's a problem for people in this room. Now, I think we've heard some suggestions about how to go about using the public sector pension platform to address these problems. And what we have, if we step back and we think about it, is we have a number of highly successful pension plans set up all across the country, set up in the Maritime, set up in the West, set up in the Prairies, set up in Ontario and Quebec, that are highly professionalized, that are very efficient, that are truly cutting edge in terms of what it means to be a pension plan, both in terms of administrative systems and in terms of investment status and investment expertise. Right? So we have these great institutions that we have built over a period of time that are best of class in terms of delivering pension coverage. And the question for us is whether we can use some of those institutions to address the coverage problem. Can we use a HOOP? Can we use an OMERS? Can we use a British Columbia a set of pension systems with their administration corporations and their investment management corporations? Can we use those to reach out beyond the current group of workers, members who are covered, and to use them as a platform for any number of things, a platform to increase coverage, a platform to validate the public sector pension experience and to offer it to others to be able to use for their own retirement savings? Can we do that? Are there ways to do that? Some of the plans have shown themselves to be quite receptive to this, in fact, quite anxious to do it. Even our largest funds consider themselves to be quite small by international standards. And some of the more aggressive ones want more members and they want more assets, not necessarily because they're driven by social or coverage concerns, but because they want to be bigger. They want more assets. They want to be able to play in bigger sandboxes. They want bigger pieces of bigger deals. And they can't get the time of day from some big international players unless they bring a lot of money to the table. The way to get a lot of money is to grow, is to get more members, is to get more assets under management. So there's a bit of a confluence for different reasons. There's a bit of a confluence of thinking and of interests around this question of whether public funds can be levered, can be used, in order to enhance private sector pension coverage. And you could think of doing it in several ways. You could think of offering plan membership to employers outside what we've traditionally defined as the scope of each of these plans, outside of the municipal sector for a municipal plan, outside of the health sector for a health plan, outside of the teaching profession for the teachers' plans. Just bring them all in as members, maybe at the same level, maybe with a different set of benefits. You could think about using a public sector pension plan as a third-party administrator, as a professional body that's capable of administering somebody else's pension plan. If somebody else sets up their pension plan, they set up its terms, but the public sector body, because it is highly expert in this area, is the one that actually delivers the service for a fairly reasonable cost. You could think of the same thing on the investment side. You know, world-class financial institutions, which some of these pension plans have become, offering to invest monies on behalf of smaller plans that aren't as professionally run, frankly, and are much more expensive to run. Smaller contributions, perhaps, to the overall question of coverage, but important. And you could also think, and some have advocated this, about opening the public system so that it offers RRSP-style arrangements, individual account-style arrangements, to either the pension plan's own members or to people outside of the covered system. Now, some of those may be attractive, some of those may not be attractive, but the point is that we have, I think today, a coverage crisis. We can see it in the private sector. We can see it getting worse. We know that politically the likelihood of a backlash is strong. And it may be useful to begin to think about ways in which public funds, especially the biggest public funds, can be used, can be levered to reach out to others, whether for union organizing purposes, if you want to bring them right into the plan, or as service providers, if you want to reach out and put these institutions at their, make them available to them. Yeah, that's challenge number one. Challenge number two is a completely different sort of challenge. Again, I think at the intersection of this world, these two worlds of trade unionism and pension plans, how can we use pension plans in a way that's consistent with the pension mandate? But how can we use them in a way that's compatible and exciting from a trade union point of view? And here I descend into the pit of the asset-backed security, the asset-backed commercial paper crisis. I know you'll hear more about it later, but you can never hear too much about this crisis. This is a $33 billion made-in-Canada crisis that illustrates some of the most profound difficulties that we're facing today. And part of why I think it's at the intersection of these two worlds is that the asset-backed commercial paper crisis is a private sector crisis. It was made in the private sector. It is of the private sector. It is not accidentally a private sector crisis. It is essentially a private sector crisis. You couldn't have this crisis in the public sector. It is a private sector crisis. And, of course, one of the themes that we've been dealing with and that you'll be dealing with, I know, over the course of your agenda in the next few days, is the tension between private and public sectors. One of the arguments that underlies the P3 initiatives, the P3 movement, is the underlying presumption that the public sector is incompetent and inefficient, and the private sector is so much better and so much superior. We've seen many instances over the course of the last decade in which the private sector has imploded and shown itself to be inefficient and incapable of managing a discrete zone of business without public intervention and public regulation. And the asset-backed commercial paper crisis is exactly that. It is exactly a private sector crisis that now falls and has created enormous distress and enormous disruption and now falls to be regulated by the public sector. And so it's important, I think, in this intersection of trade union interests and pension plans to see where pension funds may be useful in the broader sense in addressing this crisis. And I think they have a role. And in order to describe the role, I'm going to describe a little bit, and probably not for the last time at your conference, the asset-backed commercial paper debacle. And I'm sure most of you have experienced some of it. A lot of pension funds held some amount of this, although many didn't. But the essence of it was this. We had some $80 billion plus of bank-backed asset-backed commercial paper, bank-supported, which is not at all in crisis. Normal market as ever. And then we had $33 billion of non-bank asset-backed commercial paper, which is completely frozen, not working at all. Is it any accident that the banks are highly regulated and that the non-bank sector wasn't regulated at all? I would suggest no. What happened in the non-bank sector was that we had a number of financial entrepreneurs who figured out a neat way to make some money. And what they did is they set up what they called conduits, in many cases trusts, and they sold notes, 30, 60, or 90-day notes. And they said to investors, buy our notes and we'll pay you a little bit more than you can get on a treasury bill. And so investors bought the notes, and what did they do with the notes? They turned around and they invested the notes in a wide range of other instruments, including U.S. subprime residential mortgages. And why did they do that? They did that because they were paying out 30, 60, 90-day interest rates, a little bit more than treasuries, which are low interest rates, but they were buying long-term mortgages which pay a much higher interest rate. And what was happening to the difference between the long-term interest rates that they were earning and the shorter-term interest rates that they were paying out? Well, that was profit. Right? So these financial entrepreneurs were doing very well, and companies like Coventry, who were behind them, were driving these kinds of initiatives, selling this kind of paper, reaping these kinds of rewards, and making a terrific profit. And as it turned out, they weren't making enough. They weren't making enough just arbitraging the difference between 30, 60, 90-day rates and the longer-term rates that they were charging on this array of residential mortgages and commercial mortgages and other things. That wasn't enough. What they had to do is they had to enter into what's called the credit default swap market, which is actually, in principle, fairly simple, although the words and the language, the vocabulary tends to be somewhat confusing. All a credit default swap is an arrangement that moves a credit risk from one entity to another. So the simplest way of thinking about it is that if a bank lends $1 million to Ford, the bank has some risk that Ford will default. They could go bankrupt and not pay. That's a credit risk. So what they sometimes did or do is they find somebody to take that risk, to take the risk that Ford will default. And who did they find in this case? They found these asset-backed commercial paper conduits. They agreed to take the risk that a whole bunch of creditors would default. Now, when the bank offloads that risk, what they do is they pay. They pay the recipient who's taking on the risk some sort of a premium. So these asset-backed commercial paper conduits were receiving a premium, and in exchange, they were agreeing to take on the risk that certain debtors, certain instruments, would default. So if those debtors defaulted, it would be these asset-backed commercial paper conduits who would make good the debt. Now, of course, they didn't think this was going to happen. They thought this was free money. So they received the premiums. They took premiums. And all this contributed, of course, to their financial success. Not only were they making a profit because they were paying out short-term interest rates but earning long-term interest rates, they were also receiving fees, premiums, for these credit default swaps. Now, the person who pays the premium is not foolish, and they want to make sure that the entity that says that they're going to pay if there's a default can in fact do so. And so what they do is they insist that the entity that says it's going to pay if there's a default, that they have money, and that they prove that they have money to be able to make that payment. And that money is called collateral, and the credit default swap agreements require different levels of collateral depending on how people appraised the risk that, say, Ford Motor would default. The higher the risk that Ford Motor would default, the more collateral you had to put down. So here you had this financial structure, this conduit selling these short-term notes, investing in subprime mortgages and other long-term mortgages, receiving these premiums on credit default swaps, undertaking these risks that, in fact, there would be credit defaults, having to post collateral in the event that these defaults would, in fact, take place. So what, of course, happens in August of 2007 is that people become suspicious, first and foremost, about U.S. subprime mortgages. And it turns out that these conduits, which are not regulated conduits, no one has paid any attention to regulating them, are opaque. Nobody knows what's in them. No one's disclosed what they actually hold. They're issuing these notes. People are buying these notes. No one has any idea what these conduits are doing with their money. They don't know whether they're in U.S. subprime mortgages or not. They don't know that they're in credit default swaps. They don't know. Right? But because they didn't know, because there was no transparency, people got scared. So their 30-day note expired, and they said, okay, give me my money back. I don't want another 30-day note from you. And nobody else, of course, wanted to buy 30-day notes or 60-day notes or 90-day notes. So in August of 2007, many note holders wanted their money back, and nobody was stepping up to the plate to buy more notes. Well, these conduits, they don't have any money. All they have are these mortgages, which at this point, in August of 2007, they can't sell because nobody wants U.S. subprime mortgages. So people are asking for their notes, asking to redeem their notes, asking for their money. These conduits can't supply the money. The market freezes. At the same time, there's a risk that the market perceives of recession, bound up with the whole U.S. subprime crisis. So in a recession, the risk of a credit default goes up. When the risk of the credit default goes up, the amount of collateral that these ABCP conduits were required to have also went up. Well, of course, they didn't have the collateral. The only way they could get collateral was to sell more notes. But no one was foolish enough to buy the notes. So they had a double crisis. They had a crisis because people were pulling money out. Nobody was putting money in. They couldn't sell their subprime mortgages, and they had to post additional collateral. So, of course, the market completely froze. And what had to be done is a series of court proceedings had to be initiated, which are culminating in or about this period, which completely undermine the basic private sector structure that we all know and love. Right? The basic private sector way of dealing with this kind of crisis, these kinds of dealings, these kinds of structures and shenanigans, is that if people do things that cause other people losses, you sue them. And that's why you have lawyers. Right? You sue them. You bring justice to bear. You take them to court and you say that they misbehaved, they breached their contract, they failed to disclose, they had fiduciary obligations that they didn't meet. You sue them and they compensate you. Right? Well, this insolvency proceeding that we're now in wipes those rights to sue off the map. There are no more, if this plan is approved, there will be no right to sue. There will be no right to compensation. Right? The entire legal basis for this mess will be gone. And in its place, what will happen is that note holders who had bought 30, 60, 90-day notes will get 7-year notes, which they may or they may not be able to sell depending on whether a market does or doesn't emerge. They are still going to be on the hook for these credit default swaps, but the credit default swap terms have been changed so that the collateral calls are now higher than they were before. So if all goes well and the economy settles down and there's no great recession and the risk premiums fall, all will be well. But if that's not the case, if there is a recession, if credit default risks rise, then the new higher collateral requirements may again be triggered, and we will again be in crisis. And the scope of the crisis, not to be underestimated, $33 billion, you had many individuals, you had many pension funds, you had many companies, you had many small savers who had bought a house, taken the proceeds, put them into asset-backed commercial paper for a month or two while they waited to buy a new house. Widows who didn't know what to do with their with money and had some, putting it into these notes. It all kinds of people, sophisticated and unsophisticated, ordinary and institutional, bound up with this $33 billion worth of stuff. And the result has been a disaster. The result has been that ordinary people who need this money can't get it. The result's been that institutional investors who need it can't get it. And even companies like Barrick Gold, who you may have read about, who invested in this stuff, can't get it. Now, some of the very biggest players have enough of a relationship with their bankers that it sounds as though they'll be able to get it. But for the vast majority of ordinary folk, their 30 and 60-day deposits have become 7-year illiquid, untouchable deposits that are still at considerable risk. And this is what the private sector has wrought in this area. Now, what's the intersection between pension funds and the asset-backed commercial paper crisis? I think it's this. Many pension funds have had this stuff, number one. And even if they didn't have this, I would argue that pension funds need to know what's going on. And more significantly, the question that is now on the table, not just because of asset-backed commercial paper in Canada, but also because of similar auction rate security scandals in the United States, subprime mortgage scandals in the United States, the question that's on the table is what form of regulation the financial markets now need. And it's a very big question. And there's a lot of uncertainty about whether this form of financial regulation or deregulation that has developed over the course of the last 20 or 25 years can continue, whether it should continue. And this will be an intensely political debate. Pension funds have to play a role in that debate. They're uniquely situated because they are sophisticated, because they do know about these markets, because they can learn a lot more about these markets, because they're highly credible as major financial institutions when they advocate for change, including regulatory change, and because they can be seen, even outside the membership and society at large, in something of the way that the CLC was perhaps seen in the 50s, as advocates where ordinary people have no advocates. I mean, who is going to advocate for the widow holding 30 and 60 day commercial paper. Who's going to advocate for the guy who sold their house and now is stuck with 7-year notes that some financial entrepreneur has manufactured for them? You need a sophisticated, you need a concentrated, and you need an able institution to be able to move the ball forward on this set of issues. And you know, again, this issue treads on the public-private divide. Behind this whole financial entrepreneurialism has been the notion that the private sector is good, and private sector entrepreneurship needs to be unleashed. It can't be regulated. Regulation is destructive. It inhibits innovation. It inhibits creativity, and so on and so forth. And this is what it's wreaked. There's no group in the country that has as keen an interest and as keen a sensitivity to the utility of the public sector as this group here. Which brings me to the third challenge, which is another one that was on your agenda last year and is on your agenda this year, and so it's not original in any sense of the term, and it's the P3 challenge. Perhaps the bitterest element of the P3 challenge is what underlies it. And what underlies it is the same kind of thinking as underlay the deregulation of financial markets, and that is the private sector is best. The public sector is badly managed, it's inefficient, it's expensive, it can't do these things. The private sector is the way to move forward. That's what underlay financial deregulation. That's what underlies P3. And it's offensive. No one knows that better than you. It's founded on a very aggressive private sector ideology. But this one's, I think, one of the most difficult of the challenges for pension funds to face. So I'll be interested to hear how you all think about resolving it, because I don't have a lot of suggestions about how to move this ball forward. I can tell you how I think about the problem and what some of the factors are, and maybe that'll help and maybe it won't. The P3 issue raises two starkly contradictory questions for public sector funds. One arises from the fact that these pension funds are financial institutions. You know, we know that when we fund a pension plan, we need a rate of return. Right? The contributions that you make to a pension fund aren't enough to deliver the benefit. You must earn a rate of return. And if you earn more than that rate, we know what happens. If it's a jointly trusteed plan, there's a surplus. Surpluses can be used to improve benefits and improve pensions. They can be used to reduce contributions. They can be used to buffer against future shocks. Generally speaking, we like surpluses. We like extra returns. Those are good things if you're sitting around a pension table. Conversely, if you don't get the returns, then you don't have enough to pay the pensions. You have to raise contributions to a certain point, or you have to cut benefits depending on the arrangement. We all know that. So the pension fund is dependent on earning returns, and the way it earns returns is that it buys financial instruments. So we can't ever act as though pension funds are not part of this financial economy. They are. They have an obligation. They have a need to earn these returns. And that need is legally enforceable. That requirement, I should say, to earn a return, to earn a good return at a prudent degree of risk, is a legally enforceable obligation. And it's an obligation that's owed to many people who depend on these funds for their retirement incomes. So that's factor number one that we have to digest when we're dealing with pension funds and P3s. But the other factor, of course, is that your funds in particular cover public sector workers. And as Paul pointed out in his remarks, there can be a real conflict between the P3 investment and the employments or the terms and conditions of employments of public sector workers. These are very powerful opposing forces, very powerful opposing factors. And finding a way through the P3 maze, I think, is very challenging. It's very tough because you are dealing with the financial reality of these institutions, which is a legally enforceable reality. On the other hand, you are dealing with something that is, for many, deeply offensive. Maybe not in every form, but in many forms, deeply offensive. So that, I think, is an enormous challenge and one that it's important to step through carefully. So those are the three challenges that I wanted to speak to. The first one, I thought I'd heard some fairly good suggestions about how we might mobilize public sector plans to actually help in the coverage area. The second, I think, illustrates how pension funds can find themselves at the crossroads of some very significant political issues that are deeply important to the public sector and that reflect on the appropriate balance between the private and public sectors. And the third's a tough one. The third I know you'll be discussing for the next couple of days, and I wish you all the best. So I was asked to speak for about half an hour and then to leave time for questions. So.
Thank you, Murray. If anybody's got any questions, please come up to the mics and please keep your questions brief so we can get through as many questions as we can before the end of our program.
Hi, my name is Hugh Urquhart, and I just feel on the asset-backed commercial paper, do you think the federal government could have played a greater role in preventing it, and the actual pension managers? As you know, I'm married to Diane, and I think there were a lot of people in bed on that issue, and I'm really, really concerned when you look at, and first of all, you explained it very well, and thank you. Each time somebody explains it, I gain a greater knowledge of it myself. But like you take a look at some of the rating agencies, like, and I'll be specific, like Dominion Bond Rating, giving a high rating, and no other rating agency in the world would rate it. You look at the Yukon government, they wanted two ratings on it. Apparently they only got one. And then you look at the pension managers themselves. Where were they? Like, where were they in taking on such risk? Where were the risk managers in the banks that allowed this product to be sold out? There's a lot of questions that are pretty serious that are going to impact all of us, and you've covered some of them, but I'd just like your opinion on furthering it on those issues, which I know you're probably aware of, and you've been very polite, but maybe you could go into the dirt of it.
Well, I didn't know you were married to Diane, but congratulations on that. The federal government absolutely could have played a much more progressive role than it did. One of the features of the asset-backed commercial paper crisis is that people did realize that there could be instances in which the market wouldn't work and illiquidity, money would be necessary from a third source, and that source were banks, largely foreign banks, and they entered into what are called liquidity agreements. So they entered into liquidity agreements under which they would provide liquidity to these conduits. Now, in many countries, in fact, most countries, these liquidity agreements actually work. But in Canada, they don't work. And they didn't work in this case because of the way in which the liquidity event conditions were drafted. No one ever litigated with the banks to see if, in fact, they were obliged to kick in money under the liquidity agreements. But the committee overseeing this whole restructuring process expressed considerable caution about whether the banks would be liable. These clauses were different. They varied from conduit to conduit. They varied from bank to bank. And what they illustrate is that the regulators in Canada were not concerned about the consumers. They weren't concerned about people who were buying this paper. They were concerned about the banks. That's what they were concerned about, the banks. The banks, of all people to be concerned about, they were concerned about the banks. So they liked these very weak liquidity agreements. They thought these were good because it meant that the banks wouldn't be on the hook. So it worked. As far as they're concerned, it worked. But what it meant, of course, is that the banks in Canada have not taken enormous hits on asset-backed commercial paper. The foreign banks, with respect to the Canadian ABCP, haven't taken those hits. It's the individual holders and the institutional and corporate holders of this debt. So if we had a regulator that was concerned about financial markets, that was concerned about ordinary people who are buying financial products, we may well have avoided this crisis, but we didn't. We had a regulator that was narrowly concerned about the banks and encouraged them to avoid taking on these risks and liabilities. So, you know, I think it's a profoundly political question what the role of the regulator is. Is it to protect the banks, or is it to protect people who aren't going to do a mountain of due diligence every time they buy a piece of paper? They're going to trust, because that's the nature of the financial system, they're going to trust. Who should the regulator be protecting?
Michel, on microphone two.
Michel Lisée, SCFP, section locale 1294. Votre intervention vient d'enlever une partie de ma question, c'est que je trouvais que les banques s'en tiraient bien dans votre présentation originale, parce qu'effectivement, la différence dans la définition de liquidité, parce que les banques devaient couvrir les conduits à l'expiration des papiers au Canada, était une définition au Canada très différente des autres pays. Et dans les faits, Standard & Poor's, en 2002, dans un papier où ils expliquaient pourquoi ils refusaient d'émettre des cotes de crédit sur le papier commercial canadien, expliquaient que la clause de liquidité au Canada était tellement faible qu'elle ne donnait aucune protection. Ce qui veut donc dire que si n'importe qui au gouvernement fédéral avait lu en 2002 le document de Standard & Poor's, qui n'est pas mon ami habituellement, ils auraient su qu'il y avait une crise là, parce que même si tout le papier commercial était sain quant aux actifs sous-jacents, l'absence de protection en soi était suffisante pour que le marché s'écroule. Par ailleurs, j'ai une question pour vous. Lorsqu'on pense au PPP, est-ce qu'une de nos grandes vulnérabilités ne tourne pas autour de deux enjeux? D'abord, le maintien d'une incertitude pour beaucoup de membres de comités de retraite sur le fait que de refuser d'investir dans des PPP les expose à des poursuites, même s'il y a des risques importants et même si l'intérêt des membres était visé dans le cas où le PPP serait dans un domaine affectant directement les membres de la caisse de retraite. Et ma deuxième question, c'est est-ce que le mouvement syndical, on ne serait pas en meilleure position pour combattre les PPP si on était en mesure d'élaborer des alternatives? Je vais donner un exemple. Au Québec, on aime beaucoup donner les PPP pour les éoliennes à des entreprises privées. Est-ce qu'on n'aurait pas pu imaginer qu'Hydro-Québec émette des obligations à long terme, à rendement réel, ou même un rendement qui est lié à l'évolution du prix de l'énergie, donc il y aurait un partage de risque entre Hydro-Québec et des caisses de retraite, pour que les caisses, on ait des obligations avec un rendement lié au risque en partage de risque sur 20 ou 30 ans? On est désespéré à chercher des titres à long terme pour couvrir notre passif. Il n'y en a pas assez. Alors, est-ce qu'il n'y a pas un travail à faire aussi pour développer des alternatives et qu'on ne soit pas uniquement en train de se défendre? Merci.
Thank you. Although I can't respond in French, I think I understood the nature of the two questions. I think on the first point, the asset-backed commercial paper crisis is complex, and the banks were absolutely implicated, and I think we're ad item as to the role of the banks and the failure of the regulatory system to protect individuals. And it was very clear some time ago that the liquidity agreements, the liquidity terms, were very weak. There was no secret about that. Precise terms, of course, were secret, but the clauses, the nature of the clauses, was known to be weak. On the second question, the P3 vulnerability where you know, trustees are faced with an attractive investment, strictly on investment terms, strictly in terms of you know what the return is and what the risk is, and whether they have a legal risk in turning it down. Well, they do. I mean, and that's the problem. That's the problem with the fact that these pension funds are financial institutions. You know, they exist in a legal context and they have legal obligations. So, you know, what would be a very difficult thing to do is to say, this is a P3, we're not going to invest in it, without examining the merits, without examining what the return characteristics are and what the risk characteristics are and so on and so forth. That's a dangerous approach to take because it makes the pension trustee look to be ideological, makes the pension trustee appear to be bringing a political agenda to a financial institution's table. And if you do that, you can count on the courts to respond. For better or worse, that's the way these things are structured. In order to appreciate what the real risks are of P3s, and they are risks. I mean, every investment has a risk. Every investment has a promise. Every investment has a risk. You really have to get into them. You really have to understand them. You really have to know how they work. What can go wrong? What can go right? What can go wrong? These are pretty complicated deals, but there are a lot of contingencies that they have to address. If it's a road, you need to know, obviously, what the traffic's going to be. If you're dealing with water, there are a mountain of environmental concerns. There are a mountain of regulatory concerns. Every regime has its own regulatory principles. These regulatory principles are not immutable. They can change, and they're not easy to understand. They vary depending on circumstances, and they respond differently to different kinds of considerations. So a blanket prohibition on P3s is tough legally, tough to defend legally. On the other hand, there's an obligation to get into the risks and reward characteristics of any investment, including a P3. And I think Michelle's absolutely right. To the extent that the focus has shifted from a defensive focus, which the P3 focus essentially is, it's a defense of status quo, of employments, of relationships focus, to a more aggressive focus on an alternative asset class or a green energy strategy. To the extent that you can change that focus, people have finite time and finite resources, including pension funds. And if that's where they're looking and if that's who they're hiring to invest their assets, they're just not going to be spending as much time in other places. The world is finite. There are choices to be made. And introducing more progressive choices may be one of the more effective strategies to deflect people's attentions from P3s.
Gary Johnson from British Columbia. As you know, we do have both an investment management corporation and the pension corporation, which is the administrative agent for five big plans. And you said maybe we can leverage what we've got into something else, and I want to say that we have just done that. We've actually gone and sought out one of the other public sector plans in British Columbia, the Workers' Compensation Board employees who are covered by their own plan. They are now having their plan administered by the Pension Corporation and saw about a 30% reduction in costs. Because those of us at the Pension Corporation, we can do it better. We are sophisticated. On the investment side, I'm also a trustee on the Public Education Benefits Trust, which in terms of dollars is relatively small at $70 million. But we have just reached agreement with the BCIMC to, in fact, take the majority of our funds to them to invest on our behalf as an education benefits trust for school board QP support workers. The savings that we will get there on $70 million is about 0.3% per year, just in their charges, let alone all of the other things that go along with it. So I guess my question to you is there any place else in the country where there is some leveraging of this going on? And I'll ask, wait till he answers.
Well, you know, people in this room may be more knowledgeable than I in response to that question, but I am not aware of it happening in Ontario, and I am not aware of it happening, I'm frankly not aware of it happening anywhere but in BC.
So, that's too bad.
I know that there are, what we have begun to see is organizing efforts among the, among employees that are contingent workers, really. They're part-time contingent attachment workers who have not traditionally participated in plans, but are in the public or broader public sectors. And there are real efforts that I've seen being made to bring those people in. And you're dealing with huge, huge potential bargaining units. And that does address the coverage question. Still within the public or broader public sector, but there are a lot of people.
The second point is that we appeared before the Alberta-BC joint panel on pension reform, or this is on the PBSA standards reform. And I think that whenever we have two provinces who are saying we're going to do it together, there's less likely to have really positive results. But one of the things that I was very interested in hearing from them was they really liked the idea that we had put forward to them that, in fact, we should create large investment corporations, large administrative agents who could then either across two provinces, across Western Canada, or even perhaps nationally, take on sectoral pensions and sectoral administration. And so they spent a good part of the hour we had with them making some inquiries about us in that way. So my question to you is, what about in Ontario, since you're undergoing this same similar review, is there any push to see large administrative and investment bodies created in Ontario?
There certainly have been the same sort of recommendations. There's been a surprising level of support for what people are calling CPP2. I shouldn't say it's surprising, but it took me a little bit by surprise because I hadn't expected it from as many quarters as we got it. CPP2, in different forms, would either be mandatory if you listen to the CLC, or it would be voluntary if you listen to the CFIB. The Canadian Federation of Independent Business advocates a voluntary tier 2 of CPP. So you would essentially double coverage if you opted into it. Wouldn't be mandatory, but small employers could provide pension benefits through CPP. So we heard a number of trade unions and trade union entities and the CFIB speak to CPP2. There have also been a number of ideas to spawn multi-employer industry-wide funds to create large-scale centralized investment or administration funds. More, I would say, in Ontario in the multi-employer area. But I see two challenges. One is, in our case, I think maybe in the BC and Alberta case too, the mandates that the commissioners are working with are not that broad. They actually don't ask this question. So they, depending on the attitude of the commissioner, they maybe interpret a little bit more broadly or a little bit less broadly, but the mandate is a mandate that, for better or worse, we've inherited from a decade or more of employer lobbying. And make no mistake about the reason that we're seeing all these commissions now. It's because the employer side has been pushing very hard for a decade, maybe more, on surplus issues, funding issues. They went through what they called the perfect storm at the beginning of the decade, and there was a lot of writing and talking about that. If you look at the questions that are being raised in the mandates, they are questions of this nature, questions about surplus, questions about funding. And they're not so much questions about CPP2 or industry-wide plans or what we're really going to do to crack this coverage problem. So, you know, there's room for creativity in these mandates, I hope, but you know, this is the legacy that we have at the moment. If there's a lesson learned from that, it's that all this whining that they've done, the employer side has done over the last decade or more, has paid off. And even if it may seem difficult and it may seem futile to be advocating what are really good ideas, like CPP2 or like industry-wide plans, give it a decade and see where it goes. I mean, as we see declining coverage rates and as we see the failure of the existing arrangements, you may well see a second set of reforms that would more likely go in those directions.
Are there any other questions? Wayne?
Hi, Murray. Wayne Thomas, Nova Scotia. Just maybe we can explore the P3 issue a little bit more. I sit on a plan that has $2.5 billion in assets. So it's not a large plan, but it's large enough that its investments are fairly complex. And we've just come through an investment process, and the plan is poised to go into infrastructure for the first time. So based on the response that you just gave, you know, I can see where you can sort of assess this, you know, return versus risk. If the plan was going to invest in a particular project, but if the plan's investing, you know, through funds, or if the plan's investing through, you know, funds of funds sort of structures, it's almost impossible to get at the, you know, individual risk return for each one of those various investments. And we probably have a new group coming in, a new group of trustees coming in that, you know, would talk about whether or not it's possible on a policy basis to sort of limit the investments around some of these structures. But that's troublesome with what you just said. So I can appreciate, you know, that look if you're investing in a particular project. But if you're not, if it's just a, you know, 10% invested in infrastructure and you've got various vehicles on how you do that, I don't know how you possibly fence in some of those limits unless you can do it through policy. So I'd be interested in hearing your comments.
No, I think you're absolutely right. To the extent that you invest in a fund, you have much less control over what the fund does. I guess there are only two or three things that one can say. Well, presumably there are more. There are two or three things that come to my mind. One is that funds of funds are expensive. Right? Every time you hire another intermediary, there's a fee. And a fund of funds would typically have a fee at the fund of fund level, the entity that chooses the funds in which to invest. So you get a broad grouping of funds, but you're paying a fee on top. You're paying then a fee to each fund manager. And then you're paying all the fees that you would normally pay for the transaction. So you pay the transaction fees, you pay the fund fees, and then you pay the fund to fund manager fees. And that's a lot of fees. It's a lot of fees. So these investments have to be really, really attractive to bear those fee loads, because these fee loads are not low. I mean, they're typically... Well, they will vary, but in that kind of private equity world, they're often 2% of assets under management plus a certain percentage of the return above a certain threshold. The fees can be really, really big, and to the extent that you're looking at fund of funds for private equity or for infrastructure or for hedge funds, that's a first set of very significant questions, because these investments have to deliver quite enormous returns in order to get over those thresholds. At that point, too, it's an asset allocation decision. Right? And that's to the extent that you're putting money into a fund to fund, what you're really deciding to do is to allocate a certain proportion of your assets to hedge funds or to infrastructure funds or to private equity funds. And that's an area that's not at all an easy area. And the decision at that stage is whether to allocate 10% of your fund assets to infrastructure or whether to allocate 10% to something else. So the debate at that stage, you're right, isn't about the risks and the rewards of a particular investment. It's about the risks and rewards of the asset class, and especially an asset class that's mediated through so many fee levels. That to me would be the first line of questioning to take.
Okay, are there any other questions for Murray? Microphone one.
Yes, Marc Boularis from Quebec. Is there an association of union committee from all the Canada to make pressure to the government to equalize the pressure that made on the government from the private sector to the workers? Like the government have a lot of pressure from private sector to make laws. Is there from the workers a pressure or from a union? Is there an organization of workers that make pressure from to the government as a union committee pension plan? I'm better in French, but...
No, you're very clear. I understand your question. I'm not sure I know the answer.
Yes. CLC and Bio-Québec, FPU. That would be the answer.
Claude knows the answer. There you go.
We should explain... When I talk about one small example there, the bankruptcy legislation, that came first from the steelworkers in Quebec and Ontario. Then it came to the CLC, and with the support of the FTQ and the CTC, the CLC, and a minority government situation, the support from the Bloc, the Liberals, and the NDP, the Conservative government didn't want to do it. That's how that happened. There needs to be many more examples of coordinated worker effort, not just at the federal government, but at provincial regulators. Our provinces create regulations for our pension frameworks, major commission in Ontario right now. But the CLC, the CTC, is the proper umbrella group to forcefully bring forward a whole range of pension-related issues, working in concert with the FTQ.
Thanks, Paul. Seeing no other questions, please join me in thanking again Murray Gold.